T-minus 20 seconds. Ten, nine, eight, seven, six, five, four, three, two, one, zero.
Hello, hello, everyone. We are live. It is Wednesday, May 24th, and it's 7 p.m. local time here in Texas. If you're tuning in live, let me know in the comment section. As always, if you can hear me, if you can see me, and where in the world you're watching from. Now, it's been a bit of an interesting week. This evening, I've actually been tuning in, or I guess trying to tune in to the Ron DeSantis presidential bid announcement on Twitter, I should say, on Twitter Spaces. That has been a choice. Now, first and foremost, and I'll get into this a little bit more later, but I am not someone who is going to come on here endorsing any presidential candidate. I mean, I am more than happy to point out things certain candidates do that are done well, things that are really, really not done well. Definitely here to criticize a lot of what they do and say, because these are politicians and they put themselves up for criticism at the end of the day, and they deserve to be held accountable. So when it comes to someone like Ron DeSantis, I mean, I think he kind of falls into that category where there are certainly things that he's done well, and there certainly are a lot of problematic things about him and surrounding him. And of course, you also have him going up against someone like Donald Trump. So I'll get into that as kind of more of a U.S. election update, shall we say. And y'all can let me know if you want to see more of those or if that's something you're not interested in. I know that a lot of my audience is international. And so for some of you, if you hear things about the U.S. presidential election, that may be boring as all get out to you. And then for others, it may be interesting to just kind of see what's going on. So don't worry, there's still a lot of international news mixed in there for sure. I do think that the decision to go through Twitter Spaces is definitely interesting, because similar to, you know, the decisions that we've seen to go against traditional media, because typically you would have someone like Ron DeSantis having an interview with Fox News, making this announcement, doing some kind of press conference. And so for him to go through Twitter is a very notable choice on his end, and it could impact the way that he's covered. Clearly, he's trying to get straight to the American people in that way of, you know, coming on, because like on a live stream, like we're on now, this is a conversation between me and y'all can interact and leave comments and be a part of it more so than just on traditional TV. So I think it could be the beginning of really a lot of what we'll see on the campaign trail. I mean, you also have other candidates like RFK Jr., who has done a lot more interviews with alternative networks, with alternative journalists and that sort of thing. And so it really is branching beyond just the establishment. And then, of course, you have the establishment and how they're going to react to that. Now, let me check in on the comments just to make sure y'all can actually hear me and I haven't been rambling to myself and only myself. Alrighty, it looks like we're good to go so far. Okay, so as I was looking, as I was looking for stories, I've been kind of looking throughout the day, and one of the stories that just came up was published by, well, it's a write-up that was published from the New York Times story. And I don't know if you remember recently, there was a story and there were the videos that were circulating on social media, of course, of the attack on the Kremlin. Now, it didn't do a ton of damage, but still it was an attack. And there were countless people, not just on social media, but also in the media, that were trying to argue that this was a false flag attack, that this was something Russia had planned against itself. And now they are changing their tune. Not surprisingly, this is exactly how they do it. I feel like it's most of the time, something happens to Russia, to Russian infrastructure, and the immediate race by the mainstream media is to say, oh, well, Russia did that to itself. And then you have like now we have these anonymous officials that come out and suggest otherwise. So the headline of this write-up from RT is U.S. officials believe Ukrainians attacked Kremlin. That's coming from the New York Times, saying Kiev had denied responsibility for the drone incident while Western media outlets called it a Russian false flag. They say that one of Ukraine's military or intelligence special units was quote unquote likely behind the May 3rd drone attack in Moscow. The New York Times reported on Wednesday, citing, of course, anonymous U.S. officials. U.S. intelligence agencies have assessed this based in part on intercepted communications of both Russian and Ukrainian officials, according to the Times. However, they do not know which unit carried out the attack. Sure. And some officials believe that Zelensky may not have been aware or involved. The U.S. reportedly does not have specific evidence yet as to which operatives or agency was involved. Two drones went down in the Kremlin airspace earlier this month. Video from surveillance cameras showed one exploding above the roof of the building hosting presidential offices, saying that President Vladimir Putin was not there at the time. Moscow accused Kiev of attempting to assassinate Putin and vowed retaliation. Zelensky, who had just left for a tour of the EU, denied Ukraine had anything to do with it. Okay, so this is interesting. It's actually becoming standard for the New York Times and kind of their response to these sort of things, because this article reminds me so much of what they did when it came to the attacks on the Nord Stream pipelines. If we remember, the mainstream media immediately said, oh, it must be Russia. Russia must have attacked its own multi-billion dollar pipeline. Instead of just turning off the supplies, if they decided to do so, they insisted that Russia must have been behind the attacks and the sabotage on its own infrastructure. Then you have award-winning journalist Seymour Hersh come out, and he writes this, you know, massive investigative report saying that not only was the United States behind this, the Biden administration more specifically, but that they had been planning this for months before the war even started, that this kind of attack was in the works. It was just about deciding how to carry it out. And that also goes along with the statements that we've heard from members of the Biden administration who have spoken out and said things like the Nord Stream pipelines will be no more, or that they would make sure and that they would see to it that the pipelines did not exist, were not working in some form. So you have Seymour Hersh come out and draw attention to the entire incident, because for the mainstream media, for the most part, if they decide that they want to cover something up, they're all in agreement on that. It's exactly how they do it. If you notice, it's one of those things where if one outlet reports on it, then it spreads like wildfire. But if none of them do, then they kind of keep it that way. It's almost like they have some sort of unspoken agreement between them. Now, you have someone like Seymour Hersh come out and draw attention to the Nord Stream attacks. And then suddenly you start getting reports from the New York Times. And what do they say? They paint this bizarre picture where they say, okay, it definitely wasn't the United States, but it was this, you know, random fringe Ukrainian groups, we think, that came up with an attack like this all on their own. Definitely wasn't the Ukrainian government, wasn't the U.S. government. And they try to put off the blame onto these outside sources, these third-party groups, so to speak. Now, this article almost reads like that, where it's like, oh, it's someone within the intelligence community. Zelensky probably didn't know about that. And it's like, if you're thinking about it, and let's say that, you know, whoever is writing up this article at the New York Times, they're talking to their sources in the intelligence community. They're promising that they are going to keep them anonymous. And I'm just sitting here reading this and going, whoever's doing this interview, getting these quotes, why are they not asking more questions about this? Why are they not diving in deeper to say, okay, well, let's say that it was someone within Ukrainian intelligence who made this decision. Why was Zelensky not aware? Why was this not stopped? I mean, why is there not enough importance placed on the fact that we are in a situation where Ukraine is looking at a conflict with Russia that could possibly escalate to nuclear war? So you would think that the message to everyone in the Ukrainian government and in the Ukrainian military is, this is what's at stake here. maybe don't do this, maybe don't carry out a direct attack on the Kremlin, because that could lead to a very severe response. Now, it'll be interesting to see what else comes out on this, but I do think the timing of it is notable, because this is exactly how it happens. Anytime that there is an attack on Russian infrastructure, then you get those immediate claims that it must have been Russia targeting itself. And then weeks or even months later, you get these reports that quietly kind of come out and say, well, maybe it was someone within Ukraine, probably still not going to put the blame on Ukraine or the U.S., but we're going to throw these claims out there and then hope that we just quietly move along. It's as if they are issuing a retraction without actually issuing a retraction. Very clever the way that they do it, but they just expect the public to just move on and not pay attention. Now, another place where we're seeing a version of this play out is, and by a version, I mean another place where we are seeing the United States try to claim that it's not involved in this and knows nothing. Now, as a reminder here, it looks like my camera just, hold on, let me see. This camera has been the most touchy. It's the cord that hooks up to the camera that has been the most touchy. And the problem is that, let me see. I was going to say, the problem is that when I've done this previously, I have not gotten it to, oh no, that is not the camera that I wanted to connect to. I'm so sorry, y'all. There we go. This is why, if you don't do live streams, the difference between the laptop camera and the actual good camera, that's your difference right there. All right, so it actually did connect this time. Normally, it makes me shut down the program and go all through it again. So, Josh says it hasn't been 30 minutes. If y'all have been here for a while, you know that I used to have an old camera that would shut off every 30 minutes on cue and would not. So this one at least doesn't and is usually pretty good. So we will see how long that lasts anyways. So the next story that I want to get into, if my camera will let me, is the latest on the attack that happened in Russia's Belgorod region. And now we are finding out, and this is not just me saying this, this is the members of the neo-Nazi militia themselves saying it, that they used U.S. armored vehicles to not only go into Russian territory, but to commit a terrorist attack on Russian territory. Now, as this article from antiwar.com says, a neo-Nazi militia launched a cross-border raid from Ukraine into Russia's Belgorod region on Monday using U.S. armored vehicles. Now, the original article actually comes from the Financial Times, which is kind of interesting. And they talked to the leader of the Russian Volunteer Corps, who said his fighters had attacked Belgorod and were in possession of U.S. armored vehicles, including at least two MRAPs and several Humvees. Videos and pictures posted by Russia's military corroborated his claims. Now, this guy, the fact that this guy is still alive and walking is just fascinating to me, because every time he's involved in some sort of attack on Russian territory, he takes to social media and posts like crazy. And as the article goes on to say, he's a well-known extremist who has ties to neo-Nazis across the world and has his own white nationalist clothing line. According to the Financial Times, the Russian Volunteer Corps includes self-avowed neo-Nazis. Now, this is an interesting group, and they're with another version of their group, the Russia Free Legion, I believe, that they're called. Now, what's notable about them is that these are Russian citizens. However, they are self-described neo-Nazis. Their beliefs very much line up with the right-wing neo-Nazi extremist beliefs, and they're so much so that they have decided to leave Russia and to go to Ukraine, because that is the neo-Nazi haven there, which is, it's hilarious to see the way that the media tries to juggle all of this, because on one hand, they want to say, no, Ukraine has no neo-Nazis, that's not a problem. And then on the other hand, you have guys who are literally saying that because of their extremist beliefs, they have left their country, gone to Ukraine, and they're now committed to carrying out terrorist attacks against their own home country. So that's the guys that we are dealing with here. And in some cases, the media wants to acknowledge them. In other cases, it just tries to downplay it as much as possible. So I want to get into the article that was originally posted by the Financial Times, because they're not just interviewing this guy, they're also interviewing a Ukrainian intelligence official about it. And they have a similar title saying, "Militias used U.S. armored vehicles in attack over Russian border," saying, of course, Kiev denies involvement, but one official admits cooperation with the sabotage groups. And that official was actually named too, which is rare these days. All right, so they say far-right militias who stormed a Russian border region, or Russian region bordering Ukraine this week, used U.S.-made tactical vehicles in the attack, raising questions over Kiev's support for the Ukraine-based Russian extremist groups. Now, Ukraine has denied direct involvement in the raid on Monday. Okay, so they talk about this leader of the Russian Volunteer Corps, and they go on to say some but not all images of U.S.-made vehicles in the raid were taken on the Russian side of the border, according to this Financial Times analysis. Still, it's funny to me that the Financial Times is really getting into this and that they're one of the main outlets that is really getting into this. They note that Ukraine has received the same military vehicles from the U.S. as part of the $37 billion worth of assistance provided to the country in the last year. Okay, so American officials, of course, say that they are denying any involvement. The State Department has gone as far as to try to insist that some of the images that are being posted of these armored vehicles on Russian territory can't be real. I know I've seen some back and forth about that on Twitter, which was kind of interesting, debate over whether these photos were photoshopped. Well, then you get the videos and it looks very clear, but you know, people will debate anything at the end of the day. Okay, so now we get to the Ukrainian officials who are actually talking and speaking to the Financial Times, saying that one official from Ukraine's military intelligence directorate acknowledged for the first time some form of cooperation with the Russian Volunteer Corps and Free Russia Legion, saying, quote, "Of course we communicate with them. Of course we share some information. And one might say we even cooperate." What in the world does that mean? Now, he said that Ukraine's military was not directly involved in the attack, suggesting that it was the Russians' own initiative, being the members of those specific groups, saying they are rebelling. He also denied having supplied the militias with any equipment. All Western weaponry obtained by the Ukrainian armed forces remains under the toughest control. I'm sure it does. And of course, Zelensky declined to comment because he's busy being anywhere but Ukraine right now. And they go on to talk about the Russian Volunteer Corps, founded by Nikitin, they were founded last summer to fight against his home country's invading army, and that includes self-avowed neo-Nazis. That is the group. This guy also goes by the call sign White Rex. That is the name of his white nationalist clothing brand, which is popular among Western far-right extremists. So not only are they getting money and military aid, but they're also getting money for his literal white nationalist clothing brand. Now, of course they have a Bellingcat quote in here. I did not see that before. All right, what do they have to say about it? I'd love to know. They say Nikitin is a real self-promoter, an intelligent, educated man who seems to be primarily interested in his own power, image, and standing. Bellingcat, who leads its research on the global far right. So he's praising the guy. He's like, look, this guy, he's not saying he's terrible and his views are terrible. He's like, nah, he actually, it's very, how did he put it? He's a real self-promoter. And he described him as intelligent and educated. That, something else. Not how I would describe someone with those views, but you know what? That's a guy who works for Bellingcat. My goodness. Okay, so you have this admission from a Ukrainian official, which is it is notable because typically, and the guy said it with his name, which I'm very impressed by because typically that's something nowadays that you would have as an anonymous quote being thrown out there. And this admission that these are US armored vehicles, which I mean, by looking at them, you can see that, but it's the acknowledgement of that that makes it so important because from the US standpoint, they come in and they say, oh, well, we throw tens of billions of dollars in lethal aid at Ukraine because that's their close ally and they want to help them out. That's their line. But then the US kind of has to walk this tightrope of, on one hand, claiming that they're aware of where how all of these weapons are being used, where they are, that they're not being smuggled out of the country on the black market, which in a lot of cases they are. And then on the other hand, the US also has to make it seem like they're hands off, right? They can't make it seem like they're too involved because they keep trying to claim that they're not fighting a proxy war against Russia. So it's this balancing act that the US is trying to do and that the media helps them out a lot of times in. Now, at the same time, you have Ukraine that is now doing a similar version of this where they say, oh, well, yeah, we have communication with these neo-Nazi groups because that was the entire thing. You have a group like the Azov Battalion. On one hand, you years ago had a media that would come out and that would talk about their extremist viewpoints. And then now you have a media that has whitewashed them and has claimed, oh, well, the Azov Battalion is not so bad. Like the extremist beliefs are all weeded out and it's fine and you should accept them now. And so it's interesting to see now you have the Ukrainian government trying to kind of play this balancing act with these extremist groups who are very clear. Someone like Denis Nikitin is very upfront about what he believes. He literally has a clothing brand based on his white nationalist beliefs. So he's not making any secret about it. He's posting images on social media, boasting about the fact that he's carrying out terrorist attacks on Russian soil. And at the same time, now you have the Ukrainian military trying to kind of distance themselves from him. Well, it's one thing if they're getting their weapons and supplies from somewhere else, but clearly not only are they getting it from the Ukrainian military, but they're getting it from the Ukrainian military who got it from the US government. So this is an interesting situation. It's one that I don't think we're going to see disappear anytime soon, although the media coverage may try to make it seem that way. But I do think it is one case that we're likely to see more of this. And it's the same kind of scenario to where you're watching these videos and you're hearing, in places like Syria and Iraq, and we're seeing these videos of ISIS coming up out of nowhere, emerging out of nowhere, and suddenly they're driving Toyota trucks, and everyone's watching and going, well, wait a second, how did they get all of that new supplies, and how did they get those weapons, and where in the world did they get Toyota trucks? Now, we look over into Ukraine and we see these self-described neo-Nazi groups. I mean, these are people who are not hiding who they are. And yet they're driving around in US armored vehicles. So it's something that the US government is going to have to answer for eventually. Now, when they get to that point, I don't know. But I do think it is important to definitely highlight those individual instances and also the way that they're covered in the media, the way that they're talked about all around, because especially with social media today, you see so much debate back and forth. Now, I think that debate is healthy. I think that it's good to have all of the information out there. Twitter is going in the right direction right now. I don't know that that will continue with their new CEO, but I will say Twitter has made steps in the right direction. I'll give them that. And so just being able to see more information out there, being able to see to have those conversations is incredibly important. All right, I'm going to check on the comments real quick before I move into the next story. Let me see. Hello, hello, everyone tuning in. One comment says, Rachel, 2024. No, I'm good. I'm good sticking to journalism. I don't think that politics is the world for me, because it's just, you know, people that are in politics, you have, well, one, they feel like they have to have an answer for everything, a platform on everything. And so much of that lends itself to not being able to do more research and figure things out as you go. It's like you have to have an answer for everything. And on the other hand, you also get people who say things, who promise things, and they absolutely don't deliver. I mean, I guess that is politics as a whole, but I don't love it. That's also why I don't come on here and endorse candidates or tell you who I think you should be voting for, because that's just not my place all around. Alrighty, a comment from Blackwater says, DeSantis just made Twitter the new go-to instead of Fox News. I'm curious to see what comes out of this. I think that, you know, people, I mean, if Twitter keeps going in the direction it's going in, then great. I mean, I definitely think that there's something to be said for getting on Twitter Spaces, for opening it up to people. You are making the mainstream networks all very mad, so there's that. Joey on Facebook says Trump should just have Ron be his VP. That could happen eventually. I mean, from what I heard, it didn't sound like, in what he said on Twitter Spaces, it didn't sound like Ron DeSantis really went after Trump, if he even mentioned him at all. I mean, this wasn't like him coming on and saying, hey, this is why you should choose me over Trump. It was more so him coming on and saying, hey, this is why I should be president, you know, and kind of going with that pitch. Versus you have someone like Robert Kennedy Jr. who came on and has kind of said, I think his comments about Joe Biden were just saying that they have fundamental differences, and he did comment on that, which at some point you do have to come on to comment on your opponent within your own party, not just within the overall presidential landscape of contenders. You see. Alrighty. I will get into. Okay. Josh says, how can they say the toughest control, meaning the Ukrainian officials who were saying that they had the toughest control on that aid from the U.S. when Warren and Sanders asked for more monitoring aid sent to Ukraine recently? Yeah, I mean, I think that that's on their end. Ukraine feels like they have to say that everything is under control so that they keep getting more stuff. If they come on and if they acknowledge, like that report that we saw from CBS News months ago that they then came and retracted, that said that only a small portion of the weapons and aid actually makes it to the front lines. If they were honest about those figures and gave some numbers of their own, then they're looking at a lot more criticism from the U.S., their biggest and richest donor. So naturally they come in and they say, oh no, everything's fine, we have these great tough controls. And then, yeah, you have members of the U.S. Congress that are coming in and saying otherwise and asking for more to be done. Another comment on YouTube says Bellingcat is a CIA and MI6 front. 100%. The fact that they're quoted at all is just funny to me, because it's like they always end up, and it's like you're reading an article, you're going through the sources that, you know, make sense. They've got someone from the neo-Nazi extremist group, they've got a Ukrainian official on there, and then you have a comment from someone at Bellingcat, and it's like, was this needed? I don't know, but it is pretty funny whenever they do include it. Let's see. Alrighty, another comment says Twitter is only pushing blue checks now. Yeah, I mean, I think that that doesn't surprise me. With Elon having people pay for it, then he has to kind of make an incentive for people to pay for it, and that's just kind of the world that we live in. Unfortunately, I think Facebook was kind of the original one that back, you know, thinking like 2014, 2013, when you had a newsfeed of people you actually followed, and then Facebook came in and made it all advertisers and different ads and sponsored content. And then now Twitter is doing a version of its own. So yeah, that's fair. I mean, I think in terms of when I say that it's going in the right direction, I more so mean in pulling back on some of the censorship. I know that they haven't done it all. There's still a lot more that can be done, that is for sure. Let me see what else we have here. Another comment says, do you think Elon Musk has the ability to influence DeSantis to win the presidency? No, I don't, but I think, because at the same time, I mean, I think Elon Musk is someone who is popular, but with a certain segment of people, and it's based more like, he always reminds me of the rich kid that has all of the friends because he's the rich kid. Like, he's attracted a lot of people because he has a lot of wealth and he gets to do cool stuff like buy Twitter or, you know, like all of these ventures that he's gone on and everything he's done. You know, there's a lot of good stuff that he's done. There's some not good stuff that he's done. But part of the reason he attracts so much attention is because he's capable of doing all of these things that none of the rest of us could do. So I think if anything, I mean, I do think that it is an interesting choice for DeSantis to go on Twitter Spaces. I think we'll kind of see more how it plays out, in the weeks to come, and really what demographic he's trying to, hone in on there. Right. Because someone like Donald Trump, part of the reason that he was so popular in 2016, aside from the fact that, you know, he presented himself as an anti-establishment candidate. He presented himself as someone who was going to tank on and drain the swamp. Now, did he do that in the 4 years that he was in office? No, absolutely not. But he presented himself to the public as that. Now, he also at the same time gained a lot of attention because he actually went and did rallies everywhere. I mean, I don't know if y'all remember, but Trump would go to all of these little, you know, Midwestern cities across the country, and he would hold rallies and he would talk to people, and he was someone who was very much acting as if he was there for the working man. And he, you know, did a lot of on the ground outreach. Now, of course, he was going up against someone like Hillary Clinton, who did not do that. Was horrified by the state that the average American lives in, is completely out of touch, although Trump is too in a lot of ways. But you have someone like Hillary Clinton who did not do that. So I think that it'll be interesting to see really over the next year what the American public values when it comes to these people. Now, granted, of course, when it comes to the president at the end of the day, do I think that they have that much of an impact on the country as a whole? No, I don't. I think that, you know, they are just a talking head at the end of the day. I mean, we've seen far too many people go in, claim that they are anti-establishment, and then end up being part of the establishment and making decisions that are establishment friendly. Now, I want to go, through a little a lot of what I cover. I know that all of these different candidates have, you know, their range of issues on domestic policy, but I want to go through some of their foreign policy stuff because I think that that is very telling about a candidate and kind of how they will be. And being in a situation where we currently have an administration that is toying with World War II on World War III, I'm sorry, on multiple fronts, I need more coffee, then it's important to look at these contenders and at least what they say that their foreign policy is. Now, with, you know, many of them, I think that it's likely that they're going to get into office and be influenced again. But it's always curious to see how they present themselves to the public. So let's go through the latest that we've heard. All right, we'll start with Ron DeSantis. And this article titled, Once a Darling of Defense Hawks, Ron DeSantis Retreats. Now, here's what's interesting, because I didn't, you know, this is not someone I've followed very closely over the years, other than just his time as the governor of Florida. But they go in and they say, former UN ambassador John Bolton, which if you hear the name John Bolton, it's never good, who has been a DeSantis fan for years, is disappointed by the governor's recent comments that Ukraine is not a vital U.S. interest. So credit to DeSantis. He's paying attention to what the people of America are saying. And of course, John Bolton isn't happy. But to have someone like John Bolton in your corner at all ever is curious. Okay, so the article goes in and said, when Ron DeSantis first ran for a U.S. House seat in Florida in 2012, the former Navy officer earned the support of one of the Republican Party's most prominent defense hawks, John Bolton, former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, known for sharp elbows. Okay, known for being a war criminal. I'm not reading that. Spoke at a Washington fundraiser for the political newcomer who went on to win the seat, impressed by DeSantis's record and his understanding of, quote, the dangers we face abroad. Bolton would also back his reelection bid to the tune of $20,000. First of all, what's John Bolton doing with $20,000? Well, I guess you see, he got that much money because he is a major hawk and it pays to be that way in America, unfortunately. The article then goes on to say, now Florida's governor and a likely contender for President DeSantis has begun to move away from the hawkish rhetoric that won over Bolton a decade ago and carried on through his three terms in Congress. The most profound evidence came this week when, in response to questions from, this is an old article because it was before Fox News fired Tucker Carlson, DeSantis said that protecting Ukraine is not a, quote, vital national interest for the U.S. That position aligns DeSantis, who is, at the time hadn't declared his candidacy, with former President Donald Trump at a time when the two appear to be on a collision course for the Republican nomination in 2024. All righty. And then they throw Bolton in there as weighing a presidential bid himself. Good luck. So it's interesting to me that we're seeing sort of this flip-flop of positions of sorts. Now, granted, you know, you have someone like DeSantis, he served in the U.S. military, so obviously he's going to be in his case, it sounds like from what we've seen from him, I should say, you have a lot of people that come out of the U.S. military and are anti-U.S. foreign policy because they've seen it and they've lived it and they've, you know, served overseas and they've seen the horrors of, you know, these wars that the United States is carrying on. And so for someone like DeSantis to run on being a hawk when he's in Congress and now to sort of back away from that, I think is notable. Now, I know that he is extremely pro-Israel, and I thought Donald Trump was pro-Israel, but DeSantis, I mean, he's made multiple trips there. He's very, very pro-Israel. So do with that what you will, I should say. But it is notable when you see kind of a flip-flop like that. Now, why is he making a change like that right now? Well, because the American people have watched the Biden administration pour over $100 billion into Ukraine. Meanwhile, they have plenty of issues that are raging at home. And so anyone who's going to go up against Biden is going to make a comment like that. And they're going to say, okay, well, you know, pouring all of this money into Ukraine is not vital for our security, which they're not wrong. However, it is a reminder of when politics come into play, which is exactly how they always do. And I just don't, you know, I don't, when I, and now granted, you know, again, earlier when I was talking about the fact that you have someone like DeSantis, great on COVID. You have, you know, when he was doing the Twitter spaces and he's talking about, you know, all of these things happening in Florida, it's like someone like him coming in as a governor, you almost have a step up in some ways because you're able to point to your state and you're able to say, hey, this is what I've done for this state. This is what I'm going to try to do for the entire country. Now, granted, do I think that going up against someone like Donald Trump, that he's going to stand a chance? I do not know. I mean, I think if Trump comes in and he's Trump and he's not, I think that there's a few areas they could clash, certainly when it comes to COVID, because what Trump has shown so far is that his emphasis is on, you know, Operation Warp Speed, getting COVID jabs out as quickly as possible. And that's something that he still wants to take credit for. And then you've got someone like DeSantis coming in and saying, well, hey, you know, I was not in favor of lockdowns. I was not in favor of, you know, mandates across the board. And they could kind of battle it out there. However, I think when it comes to someone like Trump and he knows how to win, how to present himself as anti-establishment, I definitely see him, I don't know if the right word is steamrolling, but I do think that it's likely to be one of those things where it's like, look, if you get Donald Trump on a stage, the stage is his at the end of the day. And that's one of the biggest comments that I saw from people that were talking on Twitter that were listening to the Ron DeSantis, you know, spaces. They were saying, hey, this guy doesn't seem like he has enough of a personality. He, you know, blah, 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 that sort of thing, which of course, a lot of these people are very pro Trump. So they're going to say that. Now, granted, I'm coming in here, I'm talking about this stuff. But again, at the end of the day, do I think that any of them are going to make any serious changes that need to be made? Do I think that any of them are going to make the federal government any smaller or to, you know, address this insane national debt that we're dealing with? Not particularly. No, I don't. Would I vote for any of them? No. But I do think it is interesting to kind of look at these foreign policy issues. And I mean, I will continue to cover sort of this race to a certain extent when it comes to not only, yes, what the candidates are saying, but also when it comes to just kind of that battle back and forth and how we deal with that. And now another one of these is Robert Kennedy Jr. I know I haven't talked about him a lot. I do. And he's another one of those where it's like, there are some of his positions that I can absolutely get behind. And then there are other positions where I do not know where he got those. But I also think one of his decisions is, you know, the fact that you have RFK Jr. running on the Democratic ticket, I think is going to end up harming him more so than if he would have ran as an independent, because the DNC has made it clear that their nominee is selected, not elected. And with someone like Joe Biden, the DNC is going to make him their nominee. They are not going to go in and choose someone like Robert Kennedy Jr., who, you know, has made a number of comments pissing off, whether it's the intelligence community, Big Pharma, you know, all of these different entities that the DNC relies on. They're not going to pick someone who is that anti-establishment. They're just not. I think he would have done better off if he would have run as an independent or with an established third party, just in kind of, and I know it's tricky because in somewhere like the United States, you know, you are in a position where you have these two major political parties. And so in a lot of ways, unless a third party has just incredible support, they are up against a lot when it comes to being able to win, when it comes to, you know, ballot access, that sort of thing all around. And so I think it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. But at the same time, you know, Ron DeSantis and his decision to go to somewhere third party like Twitter to make this announcement shows that there is an audience there, that they believe that, you know, people are going to tune into that more than they are going to tune into traditional media. And it also leaves the traditional media scrambling to try to catch up at the end of the day. Let me see what we've got here, if there's anything I'm missing. Alrighty, so my third story that I have slated for this, hold on, let me see if I want to go into that just yet. I think I will. Again, I'll kind of, I mean, is there's more election updates, I will cover them, just probably not, well, not as in-depth as some people, but more so from that perspective of looking at this from the situation of, okay, are these candidates going to actually make any changes in the long run, or are they just going to be same old U.S. establishment on a lot of things? And so far, unfortunately, that's what we've seen. All right, so my third story is kind of shifting gears a little bit. I wanted to go into kind of what we've seen so far in terms of other countries' attempts to facilitate peace talks between Russia and Ukraine. Because as a reminder, the U.S. has done nothing on that. They have claimed that it's up to Zelensky to, you know, decide when they should have peace talks. Zelensky's not going to do that. He's literally made it illegal for himself to have talks with Putin directly. And that's the only person from Russia he's going to be talking to. So, you know, not much on that. Then, of course, you have someone like China that comes in and they say, hey, let's have peace talks. And the U.S. freaks out. The Biden administration really freaks out. That's another comment about Ron DeSantis. He's very, very anti-China from what I've seen. And that, I know that that gets some people talking. I just don't. And I know that in a lot of more conservative circles, but I just don't think that that's the way to be. As we saw with, you know, the Trump administration and their trade war, like it ended up affecting U.S. companies more. It ended up putting more of a strain on those in the U.S. who were then having to work around tariffs, as tariffs often do. Anyways, this is another rant for another time. All right, so looking at peace talks again. So you have these other countries that are coming in and they're saying, hey, we want to facilitate some sort of peace talks between Russia and Ukraine. I know when it came to Zelensky's little stint last week where he showed up at the Arab League, you know, you had Saudi Arabia saying, hey, let's facilitate peace talks. Let's make this a possibility. Now, of course, there is an element of the fact that all of these countries that are getting involved, they, you know, it's a lot of the countries that have tried to remain somewhat neutral. And so they haven't just sanctioned Russia. So at the same time, they're coming into this of more of a neutral position. And now they're saying, hey, let's make peace talks happen. One of these calls is coming from Africa. And this is something that I think is notable because Russia has really had a lot of outreach to African nations over the last year, especially. I mean, we've seen Sergei Lavrov has done countless visits all across Africa. Russia's foreign minister has. And so it's now interesting to kind of see the return from that. You have African leaders urging Ukraine to accept peace talks with Russia. So South Africa is calling on Russia and Ukraine to work towards negotiating a peace deal. This article says that comes after their president announced last week that the leaders of six African nations plan to make their way to both Moscow and Kiev next month to promote bilateral talks. First, the cessation of hostilities. Second is a framework of lasting peace. South Africa's presidency spokesperson was quoted as saying. Now, those countries include Egypt, Zambia, Congo, Uganda, South Africa, and Senegal. They have also urged Ukraine to accept opening peace talks with Russia and to drop its precondition of a complete withdrawal of Moscow's forces from territories that Kiev claims as its own. And that's another thing here is you've got, you have Ukraine not only saying that they won't negotiate, well, Zelensky saying that he won't negotiate with Putin, but at the same time, he's putting in preconditions and saying, okay, we won't have talks until, you know, there is no more of a Russian presence in the Donbass in Crimea. And it's like, you're talking about territories that where you have the majority of Russian-speaking people. You have, you know, in Crimea especially, it's been part of Russia for several years now. And so what Zelensky's doing is he's throwing out these preconditions that just are not realistic, that he knows that there's no way that they're going to be met. And he's using them to continue moving that line back further and further out and saying, well, this is the reason that I can't facilitate peace talks. This is the reason that I can't take part in this. And so it's interesting that you're seeing Africa now come up and say, and almost, you know, one of the things, and this is, I will give credit to RT for this, they have covered this very heavily over the last year, are, you know, the nations of Africa, which of course you're talking about a continent that is very, very heavy when it comes to natural resources. So naturally, they have been the target of Western countries across the board. And over the last year, you've really seen this continued fight back against their Western colonizers, against, you know, the countries in Europe that have used and abused them time and time again. And now we're seeing a position where these leaders from these countries are able to come in and say, hey, let's talk about peace talks. Say, hey, we are going to have this conversation. Now, it's not just them. There is more than that, and so I will get to that. Another country that is getting involved is, let's see, we have Denmark is also offering host peace talks. And I think just the fact that this is a conversation that is being held is really important and really telling all around. So Denmark is offering to host Ukraine peace talks. They want India, China, and Brazil to attend. Who are those? BRICS members. The article says Denmark would like to host a summit in July aimed at finding peace between Ukraine and Russia, but such a meeting would need engagement from India, China, and Brazil. That's according to the Danish foreign minister. Now, let's see. Zelensky on Sunday sought global support at the G7 meeting in Japan for Kiev's plan to end the war. His plan. And of course, it's funny to me that it's like, if Zelensky really wanted this end, he wouldn't be going to random NATO allies and saying, this is my plan. He would be going to Russia and saying, this is my plan. Let's talk about this. Saying if Ukraine, or so this is a statement that is coming from, let me see. I believe this is the Danish official. Yes, saying if Ukraine finds the time that the time has come to have such a meeting, that would be fantastic. And then Denmark would obviously like to host the meeting. Okay, that kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier, which is that every country wants to be the country that facilitates peace talks here, right? They want this to be something that they're remembered for. But at the same time, you know, doing that outreach versus kind of doing what countries that have largely supported the U.S. have done, which is to say, oh, well, this will be something that we talk about later. This will be something we get to later. Like the countries that are actually coming out and saying, hey, let's talk about this, that there is something to be said about that. Now, we also heard a recent statement from Hungary. Let me see. Who Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban said on Tuesday that Ukraine is unlikely to win the war against Russia and that the only way for the conflict to end is through a deal between the U.S. and Russia. That's an interesting one. Saying, looking at the reality, the figures, the surroundings, the fact that NATO is not ready to send troops, it is obvious that there is no victory for the poor Ukrainians on the battlefield. That's my position. He goes on to say the war can be stopped only if the Russians can make an agreement with the U.S. In Europe, we are not happy with that, but it's the only way out. Which, I mean, I think that that's a fair assessment because he's in a position where he's saying, look, you know, for as long as the United States continues to send money and weapons and lethal aid to Ukraine, this conflict is going to continue. So really a big factor in there. And I think that that's also notable to call it out and to say, look, this is not just between Russia and Ukraine. In a lot of ways, this is between Russia and the United States because it started with U.S. involvement in Ukraine back in 2014. And now it has escalated to this point where the U.S. is quite literally holding the Ukrainian military and government together. And let's see, and not, you know, that the U.S. is playing such a major role in this conflict that if they were to pull out for any reason, if they were to even change their support notably, then the result of that would be that it would, you know, Ukraine would fall apart altogether. So to sit there and say, look, these are talks that need to happen between the U.S. and Russia, I think that that is calling it outright. But at the same time, the question becomes, when is that going to happen? When is that going to be something that we see? That is a good question. All right, let me check on some of the comments. A comment. All right, let me check over on Rockfin. I'm sorry to y'all watching on Rockfin. I've neglected that chat this hour. Chuck on Rockfin says, do you think Trump will run as an independent if he loses to DeSantis in the primary? That's a good question. Honestly, it's hard to see Trump losing to him in the primary just because looking at the Republican and Democratic parties, their sole objectives are to make money, are, you know, who they are not looking necessarily, I would argue, they're not looking for which candidate wins. They're looking for which candidate wins the most money for them, because they are a business at the end of the day. And so I definitely see a situation where, you know, if Trump keeps fundraising like he has in the past and he keeps, you know, being the one that they see that they can benefit from the most, then I could definitely see him being their candidate. Now, if in some world DeSantis comes in, is just insanely heavy on fundraising and support, I could see Trump running as an independent. I think that that could get real interesting. I'm curious to see just how far he really wants to go and just how much he's in this and what he thinks is worth it. I also think that, you see, I also think that, you know, part of what is hindering Trump right now, ironically enough, is Truth Social, because he, I mean, can you imagine Trump on Twitter right now if with the Twitter spaces, with everything going on with Ron DeSantis and that just messing up? I mean, Trump would be hilarious on Twitter. He would be live tweeting the entire thing and it would be very funny to watch. But unfortunately, the agreement he has with Truth Social, I think it's like a 6-hour lead. So basically, even though he's not back on Twitter, if he were to get back on Twitter, his agreement with Truth Social is that he would have to have 6 hours. I think the time is somewhere around there. Basically, he has to have a time limit between when he posts something on Truth Social, when it gets the first bid, and then when he can post it on any other social media platform like Twitter. So I do think that that is holding him back a little bit, because I think that a live tweet session from Trump would be hilarious. I've got another comment on Rockfin from Jim and a $5 tip. Thank you, Jim. That says your truth is so beautiful. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I'm just here trying to figure it out along with everyone else. Ronnie on Rockfin says, I don't think Denmark's rhetoric in Ukraine is going to inspire BRICS countries to take Denmark seriously. You know, I don't either. I mean, it is an acknowledgement to them that, hey, you know, if we're going to have any sort of talks, it would be good to have some other big players involved, because, you know, you got someone like Ukraine where they are backed entirely by NATO, and then you have someone like Russia where they have the BRICS alliance, they have other allies that are involved. Indeed. Alrighty, let me check on YouTube. Let's see what we have here. Other comments on here. Let me see. All right, one comment on YouTube says, think that neo-Nazis' attacks on Belgrade were coordinated from Washington to prevent peace talks. That could be the case. I mean, I think that, I think it's also to kind of, in some ways, it is, I mean, you have to remember that we had the Wagner Group just recently saying that they had taken full control of Bakhmut, also known as Artyomovsk, and because of that, then you start seeing, anytime you see Russian gains, then you start seeing these little attacks coming from people in Ukraine. As far as peace talks go, I mean, I think that a lot of that is still, it feels like we're still a ways off from that. Now, that could magically come together very fast. I mean, a lot of times those situations do, but right now it just feels like we're kind of in that middle point where we're not quite there yet. Let me see. Another comment on YouTube says, do you believe that the US and NATO really think that there is a victory to be had? Not in the sense of a traditional victory, no. I think that they are still trying to harm the Russian economy. I think that that's their biggest objective, is that they're trying to take away from Russia in any way that they can. And given that that didn't happen immediately with all of the sanctions, it feels like they still have too much ego in the game to admit that they weren't right about that. And so now they have to keep forcing that projection back farther and farther and saying, oh, well, Russia will be harmed by this eventually. And at the same time, they're also, you know, the U.S. especially is getting to use Ukraine for money laundering purposes. And we have to remember they lost Afghanistan. Afghanistan was their top country when it came to money laundering, when it came to throwing, you know, foreign aid and weapons and all of that into the country. Well, they no longer have that to rely on. So now Ukraine has become sort of their new money pit. And so for the U.S., I mean, they don't have boots on the ground there officially. But you know what I mean in terms of they don't have troops stationed there, again, officially. And so because of that, it's like a lot of this, they can ride it out for a while. It's just depending on how long the American people really put up with that. And that's why I think Politico put out a report recently saying that that there were talks that this would become some kind of quote unquote frozen conflict, which is to say that things settle down. They, you know, probably go back to fighting or, well, what the U.S. wants, what NATO wants, is just continue to see fighting in the Donbass, just as we've seen for the last 9 years. They'll continue supplying Ukraine with weapons and support, just not nearly as much as they have over the last year. That's likely something that they're considering wanting. Now, the thing is, they can push for that all they want to, but how Russia responds, I think, is going to be a big factor there, because I don't think that Russia's just going to lay down and say, okay, whatever, do it the way that you want to do it, because what that means is that we're going to see another conflict like this, you know, another decade down the road. Let me see. The comment says, what would happen if Russia found some idiots in America, armed them, and sent them to Alaska to get rid of Biden? How would the U.S. react? Not well at all. The U.S. would love some foreign interference. I mean, goodness, every time they try to come up with Russiagate, they try to come up with all these claims that other countries are interfering in this or that. I mean, it's like they would love a situation where that is actually true and actually happening. Another comment says, Elon Musk is a military contractor, an oligarch taking control of a global communication platform. What could possibly go wrong? I mean, yeah, that's fair. I think that, you know, he's benefited heavily from government subsidies, and he's one of those people who I think he knows what to say and he knows how to address a lot of issues, but at the same time, I do not fully trust him. Let's see what else we have here. Another comment says, how far do you think Russia will have to go to force NATO and Ukraine to end the war? You know, if there's anything that I've noticed about Russia, it's that they have a lot of patience, a lot more than most countries. And so if you watch the way that they have done things over the last, you know, a little over a year, for as long as this has been going on, everything has been carried out with patience. Everything has been, you know, a lot of thought and time and effort goes into just about every decision that is made. They have not, you know, they could have gone in there and just bombed Kiev, especially an insane amount, and they haven't. They've really pulled back in a lot of ways. They've been very intentional about what they're targeting and where they're targeting. And so I think if anything, it's not even about what Russia does. It's almost about how long does the US and NATO, how long do they continue to look ridiculous as they pour, you know, billions and billions of dollars into Ukraine, as they enact all of these sanctions claiming that they are going to harm, you know, Russia, and you're not seeing those effects. I mean, I think it's almost one of those things where it's going to be up to NATO to finally pull back or pull out or whatever it is that they decide to do. But it's not, I don't think that it's going to necessarily be one of those situations where Russia just changes its strategy significantly. I think we're likely to continue to see the Russia that we have seen for the last year, which is very intentional, very methodical about everything that they're doing. Now, I could be wrong about that. I'm just going off of what I have seen so far. Alrighty, let me see what else I have here because we are over that 1 hour mark. See if there's anything I have missed. The comment says war is about the corporations making more money. 100%, 100%. And even so, there was another article I was reading that was talking about how US weapons manufacturers are just increasing and inflating their prices because they can, because they know that the US is in a situation right now where it needs weapons because it's sending stockpiles to Ukraine. It needs more weapons for its own stockpiles, more to send abroad, all of that. And so the people who can profit off of it are the people who are absolutely profiting off of it. All right, I think that's just about all I wanted to cover. I really appreciate you guys showing up for another week. Looking into, I guess, the rest of this week and into the next week, I'm trying to think, kind of just same old, same old. I've got a couple of video projects that I'm working on. I will try to do another weekly live stream next Wednesday at the same time, if that works for y'all. And again, if there is some breaking news or some major story that I may hop on and cover it live, that's definitely a possibility. What I would be willing to do, and I'll send out the information on that as soon as I have it. But as far as things that are planned goes, then I should be here next week. Again, thank you so much to all of you for hopping on, for your comments as always. Thank you for joining in, and I look forward to seeing you guys soon. With that said, love.